Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Petty Officer Steve Watkins loves his toast with a fresh egg on top and a little bit of avocado. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. And what you need to know about Watkins is that he spends 3 months at a time underway, as in on a submarine where there is no fresh food like that.
Those thoughts are things that you try to compartmentalize so that you don't dwell on them. And so I usually try and wait until we've made certain transits before I really start letting my mouth water over those meals.
So when you emerge from the submarine, what's it like? Is it like is it a hatch? Is it a door? Is it an airlock? Like, what do you walk out of? Can you physically paint the picture for me?
So there's about a 20-foot ladder that you come out of. And so as you walk up that ladder, you start to see more and more light. I'm not going to lie, there is a smile that goes from ear to ear because you see the mountains and that little pinprick of sun as you get closer to it. It's just the most amazing experience to see, like, just to be bathed in light finally.
Wow. Do you have to wear sunglasses for a while?
Yes, and sunscreen.
Yeah. So besides your family, of course, and your favorite comfort foods, what else are you looking forward to when you emerge from the ship?
I have an insatiable desire for news and just to catch up on the little things that have happened in life. I think this past time, people started to wear pants that had elastic waistbands at the ankles, and it was just a small little fashion trend. I remember walking around in Seattle and seeing people with that. My wife had to say, like, oh yeah, that's a thing that happened while you were gone. So just like kind of getting reacquainted with the cultural atmosphere is really fun to pick up on those.
Well, Petty Officer Steve Watkins at Naval Base Kitsap Bangor, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Gabriel.
You can hear some of the joy that Petty Officer Watkins feels when his sub comes up to sea level. And that's our theme today. We're going to be revisiting some of our favorite stories from sea level, including how a confession led one woman to become a deckhand on a tall ship, and how one couple rowed across the Sound to claim a lonely little island that nobody else wanted as their own. But next, a story of being out on the sea in pursuit of a creature, a killer whale. Ted Griffin founded and operated Seattle's first aquarium, and he was the first person to swim publicly with an orca, Namu, in 1965. He then captured, performed with, and sold dozens of whales to other aquariums. That practice is highly controversial now, and the participants are widely viewed as villains. But some historians say that needs some context. For a long time, orcas were seen as a dangerous nuisance to fishermen. Jason Colby's a professor of ecological history at the University of Victoria, and he's working on a book about Griffin. Colby says at that time, the main MO for scientists looking to study a big marine mammal was to kill it and dissect its body.
The alternative was not between whale watching and whale catching. It was between whale killing and whale catching. The thing that made him strange in the eyes of many was that he was actually willing to go out and try to figure out a way to catch them alive and even, you know, God forbid, to swim with them.
88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe wanted to know more about who Griffin is and what motivated him. He's 81 years old now, and he told her that growing up in Tacoma on the shores of Gravelly Lake, he'd spend hours watching the life underwater.
And how did that evolve into this desire to capture and ride an orca whale years later?
Well, my neighbor had a horse, and he would ride it in the lake. And I thought, gee, I wish I could do that. And then one day I saw somebody riding a dolphin. That was Greek mythology, and it was on a coin. And I thought, I can do that. And it wasn't until later that I thought a whale would be more suitable.
And this became a truly deep-held dream of yours. It was like a vision that possessed you.
Probably something that few of us ever experienced, but my whole life was focused on getting in the water with a whale and swimming with a whale and making friends with it. And the things that I did, nobody in their right mind would have done. But to me, it was just a natural consequence of what I wanted more than anything in life. I wanted to be friends with that whale.
And so you achieved this eventually by, first you set up an aquarium on the Seattle waterfront.
The aquarium was built in 1962 during the World Fair. And I immediately began looking for killer whales and trying to figure out how to catch them. And I thought, well, I'll just jump out of the boat, put a lasso around, and I'll have him. This went on for 4 years.
And so you hired helicopters, you had seaplanes, tugs out there. How much money and effort did you put into this before you succeeded?
Well, in those days, probably $30,000, $40,000, which I didn't have, but I spent it anyway. It's the modern way, you know, for spending money. At any rate, I thought, well, I'll jump out of the helicopter and make friends with the whale by getting alongside of him. But nothing seemed to work until one day, by accident, a whale was captured in a net, which I thought was impossible.
So ultimately, it was these fishermen up near the town of Namu in British Columbia. They accidentally trapped a whale in, or a couple of whales in a net.
I'd talked to fishermen for many years about catching whales in nets, and they all said the same thing. The whales will swim right through your net, and you can't hold them. And so when I got to the town of Namu and looked at the whales sitting behind a very lightweight gill net, I thought, well, then it can't be the strength of the net that's keeping them. It has to be something else.
What was it?
It turned out to be their echolocation, their ability to see the net with sound and think that it's a barrier they cannot get through.
Hmm. And so you had scrounged together $8,000. This was in 1965, and you had to give this money in cash to these fishermen in order to get them.
Well, scrounge is a polite word. I went to the waterfront merchants and pounded on the counter until they opened their safes and gave me money. And I told them that I would be back maybe with a whale. But I raised $8,000 on Sunday morning and flew to Canada and purchased the whale that day.
How did you convince them?
Well, they knew me as a waterfront character, if you will. I used to jump in the water with seals and sea lions and swim around in Elliott Bay. Sometimes the harbor tour boat would come by and I'd wave at him, and the people would say, I have to rescue this skin diver. And of course, I had an octopus draped over my back, and they'd pull me out and the octopus would come with me. That's the way it was. They all knew me.
So you got the $8,000 together, went there, and now you have this whale.
I then had to start how I'm going to get this whale out of the rock pock where he is stuck behind nets 400 miles back to Seattle. So we got back to Seattle after 19 days, and that was the beginning of the time I spent in the water with Namu. And it's kind of tricky. You think, if I do this, will a whale do something? Well, a whale seemed to enjoy my company. In fact, it got to the point where he wouldn't let me go. He wanted me to stick around all the time.
You became famous as the first man to ever swim with a killer whale in a public exhibition. It's a practice that became very popular. What was it like for you that first time?
Well, I want to say it was scary, but it wasn't. It was just, I was being cautious and careful, but I knew I could do it. I had so much drive and energy to get in the water and be with that whale and make friends with that whale. That's all I wanted in the world.
You did develop what you describe in your book, Namu, Quest for the Killer Whale, as a really deep connection, a deep relationship with this whale. How would you describe that?
I guess I have to say that in my way, I was in love with a whale. I was in love with a whale before, and I was in love with a whale when I actually got next to him. And when I realized that he knew me, he could tell me from other people, that he would come when I would call, that he would respond to my actions. If I gave him a signal, he would obey immediately. He seemed to want to please me. And at that point, the bond continued to grow.
What surprised you the most about your interaction with him?
Probably the most surprising thing was the lack of the whale's danger. You know, if you reach in the mouth and grab the tongue, and the whale just backs up and won't bite down on your arm, and you leave an arm and a salmon in the whale's mouth, and the whale somehow gets the salmon but doesn't bite the arm, you begin to wonder, what is going on with this animal? Actually, what's going on with me?
And you would spend 12, 14 hours a day with him in the water.
Too long. I'd get out, I couldn't walk. My fingers were all rough. My skin diving suit was, I was so sore I couldn't take it off. But I had to stay in the water until I was just about drowned.
And this went on for about a year, and then Namu got sick and died.
It went on for a long time. When I moved Namu back to Seattle after making a motion picture film, Namu, the whale was in Seattle on exhibit, and I swam with him several times a day. But he did get sick, and it turned out to be the polluted water of the Puget Sound Elliott Bay. And he died from a poison called Clostridium. And as a result of that, that basically ended my relationship with that whale.
You fell into a bit of a depression afterwards, didn't you?
I never really got over the loss of the whale. And I have to be careful when I talk about it because I keep thinking it's yesterday or today or tomorrow. But I wanted to make friends with another whale, but it was not possible.
If you could talk to Namu, what would you tell him?
I'd come back. I'm still ready for you.
Ted Griffin talked with 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe. Griffin went on to capture dozens more orcas, including an almost entire pod during the infamous Penn Cove capture in 1970. Some of those operations resulted in orca deaths, and they became lightning rods for controversy over whether it's okay to hold whales captive. Griffin says he has no regrets. The reason he eventually got out of the business was because he was never able to find that same kind of connection with a whale like the one he had with Namu. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we are revisiting some of our favorite stories that happened at sea level. A few years ago, Seattle writer Nicole Hardy published an essay in the New York Times. It was about being a 36-year-old virgin and about separating from the Mormon Church. Hardy's essay turned into a book, a successful book, and that book turned into a bunch of money. And she was trying to figure out what to do with that money.
And I thought, well, I could pay down my mortgage or invest in a 401k, or I could realize that I might not ever get a chunk of money ever again like this. And so I sailed around the world on a tall ship.
Sound Effect contributor Arwen Nix picks up the story from here.
A tall ship. I didn't know exactly what that was when Nicole and I spoke.
A tall ship basically looks like a ship from Pirates of the Caribbean or the Goonies.
So we're talking like the multiple sails going
up.
Yes,
the big square canvas sails. And it's
so like the kind of ship that you see in a bottle.
Yes, it is exactly the kind of ship that you see in a bottle.
So Nicole knew she wanted to travel. She's an avid scuba diver. And when a friend sent her a link to this adventure, it was all the things that had her feeling so isolated before that made her now feel like she could do this.
So I don't have a husband or kids. I don't have an animal. And I couldn't think of any reason why not to do it except that it sounded scary. And that's not a good enough reason for me to say no.
So she went, craving adventure, wanting to get out of her head, wanting to really feel her body, she spent the next 11 months in the tightest of quarters as a member of the crew on a tall ship.
Immediately, they showed me to my bunk and gave me a broom and a dustpan. And I guess the rule is that nobody works on their first day, but I couldn't figure out anything to do, and there was not a comfortable piece of furniture. There's not a couch, there's not a chair, there's not a cushion, there's nothing. So you can sit on a hard bench all day, or you can just join in. So I helped the crew clean out the bunks and get them ready for the rest of the crew that was coming. We stood watches for 8 hours a day while we were at sea. So, for example, if I'm the 4 to 8 watch, I'm either on helm or I'm lookout or I'm doing ship's work.
What are you watching?
Watching for other ships, watching for weather, and watching for land in the distance.
From what I've read of the writing that you're working on now about this experience, the more perilous aspect wasn't what is out there at sea, but your experience on the ship. Let's talk about your captain a little bit. What was your relationship like with him, and what was he like?
He was a sea captain of the old school, and I think he probably had a romanticized notion of what his role was as the captain of a tall ship. He was charming and really smart and really interesting and moody and arrogant and a dictator. And so I've never really, I think about him sometimes like a charismatic leader that you would see on a Lifetime TV movie. And it was so hard to figure out if he was faking it or if it was real. But
like what? How did he talk to you? Like, what's an example of that?
So I'm painting the overheads outside of the captain's cabin, and he comes out and sort of stares at me silently, and his hair is wild and he's not wearing a shirt, and there are tattoos covering 30% of his body. And he's this sort of grizzled, white-haired character. And I'm a little in shock just because I haven't seen him shirtless, and the tattoos are sort of mesmerizing, and he grabs the paintbrush out of my hand. And he's trying to show me a better technique for painting upside down, and I crack some joke about how 42 years at sea will teach you a thing or two. And he doesn't think my jokes are funny, ever. And instead, he says to me, as he's looking off into the near distance, "People say he thinks he's God. I'm not God. The ship is God. The sea is God. God is God. I'm only the prophet. I interpret God."
Oh, wow.
And then he silently turned and went off into his cabin. And so I would always try to joke around with him, because I was bad at the ship's work. I was bad at the sail handling. He would start screaming orders from the quarterdeck and, "Set the spanker! Take in the jib!" And there are 200 lines to learn. And this is, you know, the first week, and he's trying to train the crew. And I can't think when he starts screaming, even though I have everything memorized. And I'm not strong enough to do a lot of the physical work, and I'm scared of heights, and you know, the other crew is climbing 90 feet in the air, our highest mast, to get to the royal yard, where there's a sail that needs to be taken in and furled when there's bad weather or too much wind. People are climbing 90 feet in the air, and they do this also at night when we're at sea and it's raining. And I realized, like, I'm never going to be that sailor. I already know I'm not going to be good at this stuff. And it was really hard for me to be bad at things and to feel stupid. And so I was cracking a lot of jokes at the beginning. And the captain just rolled his eyes at me one day and went, "Oh, God, you're one of those." And I said, "One of what?" And he said, "You need to be special." And I was like, "Oh, he's on to me too." So I think both of us were sort of intrigued and mystified and very irritated by each other a lot of the times. I think he wanted me to just always submit to his authority and always do whatever he said and never ask questions. And I'm not good at submitting to authority when I don't understand why I'm being told to do something. And of course, I trusted him completely when it had to do with like the ship and the sailing and the navigation. I don't know any of these things. I will do whatever you tell me. But certain other things, I'm not sure he knew more than other people, and he didn't like the fact that I was, I don't know, sometimes I would talk back.
With all of that being the case, why didn't you leave? It doesn't sound fun the way you're describing this.
No, I mean, there were a lot of things that the captain was very correct about. We felt like we had been at sea for a long, long time. And the captain had told us the first time we see land after a voyage like that, we would have this feeling that we had really earned the right to have this particular view of the world. And it's something that's so hard to explain if you haven't experienced it yourself, but you look at your hands that are all covered with calluses and scabs and you're bruised and you're filthy because the water, there's no hot water on the ship, and so you haven't had a hot shower, and people have been yelling at you and you feel stupid and you're not doing anything right, and then somehow you wake up one day and there's Africa, and you realize that you and all of these people working together who have become very close friends, probably out of something similar to Stockholm Syndrome. And you have all worked together to sail to Africa, and you really have earned the right to look at this beauty. And that's one of the things that will be the hardest project of writing this book that I'm trying to sort out, just to get beyond the petty feelings of frustration and irritation and try to describe this experience that is in many ways indescribable, because you're doing something that 99 point whatever percent of the world will never ever get to have.
Seattle writer Nicole Hardy talking with sound effect contributor Arwin Nix. This is Sound Effect, Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're sharing stories from sea level. Last year, I headed to the dunes just above Long Beach, which is in the southwest corner of Washington. And I found myself standing right next to about 6 feet of a backbone and some pieces of skull, basically the front third of a dead gray whale. And the remnants of that whale were actually the remains of what, under one kind of light, may look like a pretty major civic debacle. But behind it was a story that quickly transformed into a piece of local folklore. And so, to get that backstory, I went and hunted down a guy. His name is Jim Sace. He's a natural historian based in Seaview, right next door to Long Beach.
You know, it starts with a common phenomenon on the northwest coast here, and that is whales die, and they drift ashore. The whale will decompose on site, and have you ever smelled a whale that's decomposing?
Indirectly, but that's another story. So yeah, it's
that,
rough.
That forms the core of this story. But over the years, state agencies and local governments struggled with what to do with the whales. There was a famous case in Oregon where they actually blew a whale up to get rid of it. But a whale is so big, and by big, the whale that we're going to talk about weighed 15 tons, just under 30,000 pounds. Well, what do you do with it? Well, you hire a local contractor to go out with a very large excavator and bury it. And in this particular case, this whale came in here north of Long Beach, and we knew that it was going to start to decompose, and so we rolled it up the beach, just like a large driftwood log. Boom, boom.
Was the idea to do something unusual or make use of it, did that come after the decision to bury it or before?
After.
So you were able to roll it up the beach.
This is the era of Lewis and Clark and the bicentennials coming along. Remember, this is the early part of this century. And we have this 200-year commemoration of the Lewis and Clark expedition. One of the things the expedition saw when they walked up the Long Beach Peninsula were the bones of a whale. The bones of a whale. One day, Nabil Shaba, who's the city administrator, and myself were talking to him. Well, what are we going to do for the bicentennial? We both looked at each other and thought, well, we just buried this whale. Why don't we go dig it up, you know? And now when I look back on that, I thought, how crazy were we? But that's what we did.
How long had it been underground?
Not quite a year. So we got permission to dig up the whale and display the remains in the repose that it was found on the beach, laying on its side. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
And this would be an attraction for people who are walking along the trail, who came here for the bicentennial, and give them a little flavor of what it might have been like to be Lewis and Clark wandering along the beach and encountering this thing.
Right. Think of it this way. If you and I were on the beach 150 years ago, we would see lots of dead things on the beach on a regular basis. This gives the public a way to go, wow, that was pretty cool. The things that big live out there.
So you had this vision, mm-hmm. and then you thought about the whale that was underground. What happened next?
Basically, it was, well, we should just dig it up and see what it looks like. Because actually, we didn't know. So we hired the same contractor, and we went out, and we just started digging. And the mayor at the time, Dale Jacobson, was very enthusiastic about this. And so he allowed the crew to come and work, and he recruited a bunch of children out of the high school to come and work. So there was a whole gang of us out there.
This was a civic pride thing.
And it took us a couple days. And here was this striking thing. Literally all the flesh had decomposed. However, what did remain was the oily blubber residue.
What did it look like?
The soil was darkened, as if it had been mixed with extremely heavy bunker oil or machine oil of some type. And we discovered instantly that, did that ever stink? I mean, that whole area lit up like the devil's garbage dump, I mean. You could walk within like 200 or 300 yards and you could smell it. And worse, it stuck to everything. It stuck to shoes and gloves and pants. Literally, people were throwing away their wet working gear and their boots because they couldn't get it off. It was like stunning. And that hung with us for weeks, weeks upon weeks upon weeks.
Was there a moment when you were pulling up these blubber-slicked bones out of the muck, stinking the world up, that you thought, let's just call this thing off. This is a bad idea.
No. We asked ourselves, what have we got ourselves into? But by God, we're going to get ourselves out of it. Now, what we did do is we assembled all the bones, and then the mayor had, in his wise way, had concocted this method of heating up water with a little bit of common cleaning solution, and we made the world's largest bone cooking pot.
Out of what?
Out of a construction dumpster. And we slowly steeped and kept them warm for about a week while we're trying to get all the oils out of the bone and get them cleaned. And
I'm just going to stop you right there, because this has got to be the weirdest public works project I've ever heard of. I mean, this is like the mayor's idea, city crews.
Yes,
this is a municipal project to boil this whale off.
Yes, and we would comment, well, what's going on with the whale? Well, it's in the, you know, it's been cooking away. We're just boiling the bones of a whale.
Did this come up in like city council meetings,
I don't remember,
whale status update?
Everybody, as I recall, it was always more of like, this is crazy. Because you get so far into it, you wonder, have we gone in so far that we can't get out? And is this the world's craziest idea that we should just stop now and say, yeah, we tried and we failed. But no, we kept going on. And then we brought it down on a trailer and then put it in place and then epoxied, bolted it to the concrete structure, mounted the head, and voila, it looked just like a whale. It was absolutely jaw-dropping. Now, most whales that are rearticulated are hung in museums. We decided that, you know, we really wanted this on the trail, and the expedition talked about seeing the bones of the whale. So we put it up, and I watched it, and I could see that two things were going on. It began to degrade. I suspect teenage kids would go out at night and take parts of it off. And despite us having screwed and glued and bolted it together, they were prying them off. And so over a period of a decade plus, it just started to degrade. Until one point, it was like, we got to do something with the whale. And Dave Glasson, who's the city administrator, in his discussions with the council, they wisely decided to replace it with a smaller version of a wooden sculpture, which is there today.
So, I mean, this could read, if you were to be uncharitable, like a boondoggle. Do you have any regrets about it? Would you do it differently now?
I don't have any regrets, no. It's not a reason not to do art, because it truly is art.
What does it say about this community that you were able to keep everybody sort of on board for this crazy project, including the mayor, through pulling this thing out of the ground, through putting it in the giant whale crock pot? you know, people didn't really bat an eye.
Some of my economic development friends would say, well, that's our resilience. That's our resilience. And if it makes us try things out that we've never done before, that's okay, because life should be filled with a bit of trial and error. How else will we know who we are?
Jim Sace is a natural historian who lives in Seaview, right next to Long Beach, Washington, and one of the architects of the Long Beach gray whale skeleton. I don't know what you'd call it. Epic.
Myth.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks very much. Take care, Gabriel.
Special thanks to Natalie St. John at the Chinook Reporter for help with that story. Welcome back. Gabriel Spitzer here. This is Sound Effect on 88.5, and today we are revisiting some of our favorite stories from sea level. The San Juan Archipelago in the Salish Sea is home to over 400 islands. All of those islands were claimed by homesteaders by 1919. All but one, a lonely, rocky, 15-acre dot close to San Juan Island. This craggy mound became the object of one young couple's obsession. It drew them across the country. Sound Effect contributor Hannah Byrne shares the adventure of her great-grandparents.
Oh, by the way, before you start, I just happened to think, what are you thankful for today?
Well, I don't know. I'm just a little bit timid to say over the radio.
That's June and Farrar Byrne, my great-grandparents.
I'm thankful that 30 years ago I ran across the right woman. Well, here we are.
Farrar loved to sing, and when he ran out of money, he often played songs for cash.
With a plunky plunk plunk, I will sing you my junk. Perhaps it won't sound very well.
June and Farrar fell in love fast. It was spring 1919. June, charmed by Farrar's ruddy-cheeked smile and curly red hair. Farrar, drawn to June's lively eyes and fierce spirit. I asked my dad, Mark, how they went from Maryland to the West Coast. It all started, he told me, when June and Farrar rolled out a map to see where they might go.
And there was this island, which to people that lived here didn't have any value because there were no beaches and no water and no soil to grow things. So nobody wanted it.
That island was the last homesteadable piece of the San Juans. It was tiny, unwanted, a lonely 15-acre dot. And June and Farrar, they definitely wanted it. June wrote,
"To go on an island and pull the ladder up after us and live, untroubled by anything. That would be heaven."
Back then, the U.S. Homestead Act allowed citizens to apply to own land. If accepted, they'd get the land for little or sometimes zero cost. It's how much of the San Juans came under ownership. June and Farrar applied for land at the end of the homesteading flurry. When the General Land Office in Seattle replied back, "The news was bad. You're too late," they said. "You missed the boat." But instead of giving up on that island dream, June and Farrar wrote back, "Keep our application, we're coming anyways." And they took off for the Northwest. The whole journey took a couple of months.
"I love the green valley of the Cascade Range, out where the swift rivers flow, where wild eagles cry from the black crags high, on mountain peaks covered with snow."
Along the way, June sent letters to the land office every week. She wrote gossip from the journey, treated them like old friends. Farrar called it her direct mail campaign for an island. When they got to Seattle, June and Farrar walked into the land office. "Our name is Byrne," Farrar started, and the office erupted. They're here," people shouted. And to June and Farrar's delight, the direct mail campaign had worked. The 15-acre dot was theirs.
"Out where the swift rivers flow, out where the swift rivers flow."
The dot, it turned out, had a name. Sentinel. On a map, it looks like a tiny speck in Spidan Channel. In a matter of months, June was sitting at the back of a rowboat, watching their tall, green lump in the ocean get closer and closer. Then, finally, they hit rocky land. June Farrar had made it. Sentinel lived up to its reputation. Mostly trees, some grass, and a smattering of soil pockets to grow food. June promptly nicknamed it
Gumdrop Island.
And despite its shortcomings, my dad told me, June and Farrar had a way of making a rocky dot in the Salish Sea feel like something special.
They would just build a little shake shelter and gather flat sandstones and make a floor out of that. Farrar might bake bread on the fire in some kind of a Dutch oven, and he just had a knack for creating this wonderful feeling.
After they homesteaded Sentinel, June and Farrar never kept still for long. For the next couple decades, they hopped from one thing to the next. They had kids. They moved to a remote island near Siberia. They traveled the U.S. in a renovated old Dodge. At one point, June hitchhiked across the country with her young son. June used to say,
I wonder why everybody doesn't do their retiring first while they have the zest for everything and settle down later on when they don't feel like doing anything but work anyhow.
Sometimes I wonder, did the adventure gene skip me? Why aren't I living in a camper, exploring the world? But then I think about something else my dad told me about his grandmother. June was strong-willed, wicked clever, and full of a kind of fierce energy that never seemed to quit.
Life was intense for her.
Intense in what way?
Well, I think her husband, Farrar, would describe her as close to the edge of sanity, could be even, but...
And that's how my great-grandparents lived out the rest of their lives, pursuing adventure and simple pleasures with relentless intensity. Eventually, June wrote a book about their experiences. It's called Living High. And Farrar, well, he kept on singing.
I can't forget that summer day when from my home I went away.
As far as Gumdrop Island goes, June and Farrar left after about 5 years. Today, it belongs to the Nature Conservancy, returned to its natural state, a lonely little dot poking out from the sea.
That story from sound effect contributor Hannah Byrne.
To Paul and Ma, and left my home in Arkansas. Since then, I've been most everywhere.
One more story from sea level today. Colin McDaniel grew up on the water. He was raised on Bainbridge Island. And in the summers, Colin and his best friend Adam loved exploring the island's coast. Adam's father had a fleet of unloved dinghies.
They all had those drain holes under the water line and no drain hole plugs to be found anywhere. But that didn't stop us from shoving green fir cones into the drain holes and pushing our boats into the gray water and going out for adventures anyway.
Today, Colin McDaniel is an English teacher at Federal Way High School, but he was not always fond of school. Colin and Adam weren't popular or good at sports. Those early teen years were an awkward and insecure time for both of them. But that all changed with one magical boat.
It was late in the summer of 1985. In August, when we discovered the sea wolf. It was a few weeks before our freshman year of high school. And I think, you know, at that time we were anxious about entering high school. We just sat inside Adam's house and played with his Atari or impotently flicked the remote control until his dad got tired of us moping around and said, why don't you boys go out and do something with that blackberry bramble that's taking over the garage. And he gave us a pair of machetes. That blackberry bramble was enormous. It had grown down the hill and completely covered one side of this detached garage. And you couldn't see into the thing. It was impenetrable, it seemed. So we started working away at these vines. And suddenly my blade hit something quite solid. It spoke back in a ting. And we did a bit of carving, and we discovered a warped license plate on a rusty black metal frame. And with a bit more clearing, we discovered that it was a boat trailer with a small boat on it. So we ran back into his house and we found his dad and we interrogated him about this boat. And he said, oh, that thing. He and his buddy had got it at the Rotary auction, taken it out, and on the first sail, they had flipped it over, declared it a witch, and put it on the trailer and shoved it beside the garage and had forgotten about it since. We went out there and we uncovered this boat, and indeed it was a sailboat, black-hulled, fiberglass, about 15 feet long, fairly simple design, and had white side decks and a white foredeck. And inside it was gray, but the paint was all peeling off. We went back in and asked some more questions to his dad, and we shoved a ladder up into the rafters of the garage, and Adam soon found a mast and a boom, the rudder, a board, and even a bag with sails in it, and we were in business. So we cleaned up this boat and started to put it together. The grown-ups even shared our enthusiasm enough to give us rides to the hardware store or the chandlery so we could buy cleats and lines and things that we needed to fix her up. And then there came the day when we finally raised her sail, and we were terribly dismayed when up it went and we saw this big red heart. It was unmanly. So we did what any man would do. We overcompensated. We went back to the hardware store, got some block white decal letters, and we emblazoned the transom with its name, Seawolf. And so on a fair day late in August, with our work done on the boat to the best of our ability, we slid her into the water, and when it was deep enough, we dropped the rudder blade and hoisted the sails, and we were able to claw away from Point White Dock. And in a few tacks, we were free. As we learned to gain confidence in our boat, we gained confidence in ourselves and in our friendship. With this boat, we went to new places, literally, across Port Orchard to Illihi State Park, for instance, taking us to places that we had not gone with our families. And then the weather changed when we got to October. The wind switches around and starts to come out of the south. It can bring with it more white caps on the water, more challenging sailing conditions. And we enjoyed those, but we weren't fully aware of the toll it was taking on the Seawolf. And one afternoon in late October, we sailed her out on our favorite run to Illihi State Park, across Port Orchard, to the public dock where we tied up and made the journey up to the little general store we had found, where we could buy snacks and candy and reprovision ourselves for the voyage back. We set off from the dock with the wind behind us. And the wind had picked up, and we found ourselves racing along at great speed toward Adams Beach. And the boat shuddered with each acceleration as she surfed down those waves, and the vibration could be felt in the tiller and the rudder, which was shaking violently. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't feel anything in the tiller at all. And I looked back, and the rudder was literally falling into the water. And I reached down with my left hand and I grabbed the rudder blade and just held it there with my arm in the water, trying to steer this boat. So we raised the dagger board and held on for the next perilous half hour, surfing down these waves until we came to the beach and we ran her right up on those barnacle armored rocks. And there was a terrible scraping sound as she raced up there, and the rudder blade, of course, popped right out of my hand. We jumped out of the boat and pulled her up to safety. And we leaned her over on one side so we could inspect the bottom. And it looked like a great claw had just torn away at the bottom of the hull, but it was cosmetic. There was nothing structurally wrong. It would just need a bit of putty here and there and some paint. So another project. Well, first trimester came to an end and finals kept us very busy. And then my parents moved. My mom found a job in Gig Harbor. And so in the middle of my freshman year, I moved away from Bainbridge Island. And Adam and I kept in touch. But Adam was busy with other things, got involved in cross country and meeting girls, and I found other boats in Gig Harbor. And the Sea Wolf was eventually towed back up alongside the garage and left there. And over the years of high school, those blackberry vines grew back and grew right over the boat and alongside the garage. And she disappeared again in that pile of vines. I feel she was given to us. I feel she was really a gift, something that we needed at the time to grow, a vehicle in which we could sail through dark waters and find ourselves, and find ourselves competent and able. One chooses a boat because it has a certain personality, a certain grace, and a certain kind of beauty. It's like finding a mate. And I don't know that anything else that we build and design is as intentional or as beautiful or as complex as a sailboat, nor do we put as much trust and faith into that creation. When we can no longer take care of it, it takes care of us.
Colin McDaniel is an English teacher at Federal Way High School. That will do it for this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing, with help from Bellamy Palethorpe, Arwen Nix, Hannah Byrne, and Allie Ferguson. We get help with photos and videos from Parker Miles Blom, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Sound Effect has now aired 120 shows and 500 stories, and you can get our whole back catalog for free. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and write us a review. You can also hear us on the KNKX and NPR One apps. And for some visual extras and a way to interact with us, you can find and follow our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. We'll be back next week when our theme is The Beat Goes On. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.